My Aunt Margaret's Mirror. Link to HINTR. Introduction. The species of publication which has come to be generally known by the title of annual, being a miscellany of prose and verse, equipped with numerous engravings, and put forth every year about Christmas, had flourished for a long while in Germany before it was imitated in this country by an enterprising bookseller, a German by birth, Mr. Ackermann. The rapid success of his work, as is the custom of the time, gave birth to a host of rivals, and, among others, to an annual styled The Keepsake, the first volume of which appeared in 1828, and attracted much notice, chiefly in consequence of the very uncommon splendor of its illustrative accompaniments. The expenditure which the spirited proprietors lavished on this magnificent volume is understood to have been not less than from 10,000 to 12,000 pounds sterling. Various gentlemen of such literary reputation that any one might think it an honor to be associated with them had been announced as contributors to this annual, before application was made to me to assist in it, and I accordingly placed with much pleasure at the editor's disposal a few fragments, originally designed to have been worked into the Chronicles of the Canongate, besides a manuscript drama, the long-neglected performance of my youthful days, The House of Aspen. The Keepsake for 1828 included, however, only three of these little prose tales, of which the first in order was that entitled My Aunt Margaret's Mirror. By way of introduction to this, when now included in a general collection of my lucubrations, I have only to say that it is a mere transcript, or at least with very little embellishment, of a story that I remembered being struck with in my childhood, when told at the fireside by a lady of eminent virtues and no inconsiderable share of talent, one of the ancient and honorable house of Swinton. She was a kind of relation of my own, and met her death in a manner so shocking, being killed, in a fit of insanity, by a female attendant who had been attached to her person for half a lifetime, that I cannot now recall her memory, child as I was when the catastrophe occurred, without a painful reawakening of perhaps the first images of horror that the scenes of real life stamped on my mind. This good spinster had in her composition a strong vein of the superstitious, and was pleased, among other fancies, to read alone in her chamber by a taper fixed in a candlestick which she had formed out of a human skull. One night this strange piece of furniture acquired suddenly the power of locomotion, and, after performing some odd circles on her chimney-piece, fairly leapt on the floor, and continued to roll about the apartment. Mrs. Swinton calmly proceeded to the adjoining room for another light, and had the satisfaction to penetrate the mystery on the spot. Rats abounded in the ancient building she inhabited, and one of these had managed to ensconce itself within her favorite memento mori. Though thus endowed with a more than feminine share of nerve, she entertained largely that belief in supernaturals which in those times was not considered as sitting ungracefully on the grave and aged of her condition, and the story of the magic mirror was one for which she vouched with particular confidence, alleging indeed that one of her own family had been an eyewitness of the incidents recorded in it. I tell the tale as it was told to me. Stories now of much the same cast will present themselves to the recollection of such of my readers as have ever dabbled in a species of lore to which I certainly gave more hours, at one period of my life, than I should gain any credit by confessing. August 1831. Aunt Margaret's Mirror. There are times when fancy plays her gambols, in despite even of our watchful senses, when in sooth substance seems shadow, shadow substance seems, when the broad, palpable, and marked partition twixt that which is and is not seems dissolved, as if the mental eye gained power to gaze beyond the limits of the existing world. Such hours of shadowy dreams I better love than all the gross realities of life. Anonymous. My Aunt Margaret was one of that respected sisterhood upon whom devolve all the trouble and solicitude incidental to the possession of children, excepting only that which attends their entrance into the world. We were a large family, of very different dispositions and constitutions. Some were dull and peevish, they were sent to Aunt Margaret to be amused, some were rude, romping, and boisterous, they were sent to Aunt Margaret to be kept quiet, or rather that their noise might be removed out of hearing, those who were indisposed were sent with the prospect of being nursed, those who were stubborn, with the hope of their being subdued by the kindness of Aunt Margaret's discipline. In short, she had all the various duties of a mother, without the credit and dignity of the maternal character. The busy scene of her various cares is now over. Of the invalids and the robust, the kind and the rough, the peevish and pleased children, who thronged her little parlor from morning to night, not one now remains alive but myself, who, afflicted by early infirmity, was one of the most delicate of her nurslings, yet, nevertheless, have outlived them all. It is still my custom, and shall be so while I have the use of my limbs, to visit my respected relation at least 3 times a week. Her abode is about 1/2 mile from the suburbs of the town in which I reside, and is accessible, not only by the high road, from which it stands at some distance, but by means of a greensward footpath leading through some pretty meadows. I have so little left to torment me in life, that it is one of my greatest vexations to know that several of these sequestered fields have been devoted as sites for building. In that which is nearest the town, wheelbarrows have been at work for several weeks in such numbers, that, I verily believe, its whole surface, to the depth of at least 18 inches, was mounted in these monotrucks at the same moment, and in the act of being transported from one place to another. Huge triangular piles of planks are also reared in different parts of the devoted messuage, and a little group of trees that still grace the eastern end, which rises in a gentle ascent, have just received warning to quit, expressed by a daub of white paint, and are to give place to a curious grove of chimneys. It would, perhaps, hurt others in my situation to reflect that this little range of pasturage once belonged to my father, whose family was of some consideration in the world, and was sold by Patches to remedy distresses in which he involved himself in an attempt by commercial adventure to redeem his diminished fortune. While the building scheme was in full operation, this circumstance was often pointed out to me by the class of friends who are anxious that no part of your misfortune should escape your observation. Such pasture ground, lying at the very town's end, in turnips and potatoes, the parks would bring out 20 per acre, and if leased for building, oh, it was a gold mine. And all sold for an old song out of the ancient possessor's hands. My comforters cannot bring me to repine much on this subject. If I could be allowed to look back on the past without interruption, I could willingly give up the enjoyment of present income and the hope of future profit to those who have purchased what my father sold. I regret the alteration of the ground only because it destroys associations, and I would more willingly, I think, see the Earl's closes in the hands of strangers, retaining their sylvan appearance, than know them for my own, if torn up by agriculture, or covered with buildings. Mine are the sensations of poor Logan. The horrid plough has raced the green where yet a child I strayed, the axe has felled the hawthorn screen, the schoolboy's summer shade. I hope, however, the threatened devastation will not be consummated in my day. Although the adventurous spirit of time short while since past gave rise to the undertaking, I have been encouraged to think that the subsequent changes have so far damped the spirit of speculation that the rest of the woodland footpath leading to Aunt Margaret's retreat will be left undisturbed for her time and mine. I am interested in this, for every step of the way, after I have passed through the green already mentioned, has for me something of early remembrance. There is the stile at which I can recollect a cross child's maid upbraiding me with my infirmity as she lifted me coarsely and carelessly over the flinty steps, which my brothers traversed with shout and bound. I remember the suppressed bitterness of the moment, and, conscious of my own inferiority, the feeling of envy with which I regarded the easy movements and elastic steps of my more happily formed brethren. Alas! These goodly barks have all perished on life's wide ocean, and only that which seems so little seaworthy, as the naval phrase goes, has reached the port when the tempest is over. Then there is the pool, where, maneuvering our little navy, constructed out of the broadwater flags, my elder brother fell in, and was scarce saved from the watery element to die under Nelson's banner. There is the hazel copse also, in which my brother Henry used to gather nuts, thinking little that he was to die in an Indian jungle in quest of rupees. There is so much more of remembrance about the little walk, that, as I stop, rest on my crutch-headed cane, and look round with that species of comparison between the thing I was and that which I now am, it almost induces me to doubt my own identity, until I find myself in face of the honeysuckle porch of Aunt Margaret's dwelling, with its irregularity of front, and its odd, projecting latticed windows, where the workmen seem to have made it a study that no one of them should resemble another in form, size, or in the old-fashioned stone and tablature and labels which adorn them. This tenement, once the manor house of the Earl's closes, we still retain a slight hold upon, for, in some family arrangements, it had been settled upon Aunt Margaret during the term of her life. Upon this frail tenure depends, in a great measure, the last shadow of the family of Bothwell of Earl's Closes, and their last slight connection with their paternal inheritance. The only representative will then be an infirm old man, moving not unwillingly to the grave, which has devoured all that were dear to his affections. When I have indulged such thoughts for a minute or two, I enter the mansion, which is said to have been the gatehouse only of the original building, and find one being on whom time seems to have made little impression. For the Aunt Margaret of today bears the same proportional age to the Aunt Margaret of my early youth that the boy of 10 years old does to the man of, Burr Lady, some 56 years. The old lady's invariable costume has doubtless some share in confirming one in the opinion that time has stood still with Aunt Margaret. The brown or chocolate-colored silk gown, with ruffles of the same stuff at the elbow, within which are others of Mechlin lace, the black silk gloves, or mitts, the white hair combed back upon a roll, and the cap of spotless cambric, which closes around the venerable countenance, as they were not the costume of 1780, so neither were they that of 1826, they are altogether a style peculiar to the individual Aunt Margaret. There she still sits, as she sat 30 years since, with her wheel or the stocking, which she works by the fire in winter and by the window in summer, or, perhaps, venturing as far as the porch in an unusually fine summer evening. Her frame, like some well-constructed piece of mechanics,